From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Sexual harassment at the United Nations, how the world body fails to protect women's bodies. Some plain talking about late-term abortion, then bust Mickey, not unions. That's the cry of the anti-sweatshop movement, now being joined by the Communications Workers of America. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Russia has reluctantly agreed to the Clinton administration's push to expand the NATO military alliance to include Moscow's former satellites in Central Europe. The accord between NATO and Russia sets the terms under which the alliance is expected to admit Poland and the Czech Republic, Hungary, and perhaps other Central and Eastern European nations left behind the Iron Curtain after the 1945 Yalta Pact. And this news from Washington, challenging decades of housing policy that favored the neediest, the House has voted to repeal the landmark 1937 Depression-era public housing law. The measure would cut roughly in half the percentage of extremely poor tenants living in public housing, now roughly 75%, through attrition. The measure would also require many public housing tenants who are unemployed to work 8 hours a month, or in most cases, risk eviction. This news from Washington State, an explosion at a defunct plutonium processing plant at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation ruptured a water line and blew out windows and a door. At least at this point, the company is saying no radiation was released. Meanwhile, in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, wanna buy an ex-disaster? Three Mile Island is for sale. There aren't any for sale signs on the plant's huge cooling tower south of Harrisburg, but the site of the nation's worst commercial nuclear accident is on the market. Its owner, General Public Utilities, is trying to cash in on the coming deregulation of the electric utility. TMI's Unit 2 has been inoperative since the March 1979 accident. The reactor core overheated and partially melted down, releasing radioactive gases. But Unit 1 continues to operate. This news from Miami. Demonstrators cheered and waved flags after a federal judge agreed to temporarily block the deportations of between 30 and 40,000 Nicaraguan nationals. U.S. District Judge James Lawrence King said yesterday no one will be deported shortly after granting a temporary restraining order in a lawsuit filed on behalf of the Nicaraguans. The INS, he said, should not be putting these people on planes and taking them out of here because once they're gone, their cases are over. This news from Kinshasa, Zaire. The word bloodbath was on many lips today as the residents of Kinshasa brace for a possible imminent battle for Zaire's capital. Commentators in the city not only fear the battle with advancing rebels, but also the government army spiraling out of control in the city of 5 million, the last bastion of the dictator Mobutu Sese Seko. Meanwhile, Mobutu flew back to the capital today after the abortive bid to hold a second round of talks with rebel leader Laurent Kabila. Airport sources said he flew in from Pointe Noire in neighboring Congo, where he spent the night after Kabila, reportedly raising new security concerns, declined to join South African-sponsored talks. From Rhode Island, the gun believed to have killed Martin Luther King Jr. was fired for the first time in nearly 20 years as part of James Earl Ray's latest effort to prove his innocence. Weapons experts donned raincoats and safety goggles to shoot the gun six times yesterday into a 900-gallon water tank, then fished out the bullets for testing. Ray, who pleaded guilty to assassinated King but then recanted, hopes tests on his rifle will show the bullet that killed the civil rights leader in 1968 came from another weapon. Such a conclusion could pave the way for the trial he has wanted for decades. And finally, Oklahoma City bombing jurors saw photos taken by a surveillance camera at an apartment building near the blast site showing a Ryder truck passing by minutes before the area was rocked by a massive explosion on April 19, 1995. The face of the driver was obscured by glare in the photos. And you're listening to Democracy Now! The House and Senate are again trying to outlaw certain late-term abortions. The Republican-sponsored legislation, known as the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act, would ban a certain type of late-term abortion called intact dilation and evacuation. Pro-choice activists say the procedure is often necessary for the health of the mother and is being used as a wedge to go after Roe v. Wade overall. President Clinton has thus far supported pro-choice groups on the issue, but the White House has now been saying that the president will likely sign some version of the bill. Here to talk about late-term abortions is journalist and author Angela Bonavaglia. She just wrote the cover story in the May-June issue of Ms. Magazine called Separating Fact from Fiction: The Latest Battle Over a Woman's Right to Terminate a Pregnancy has generated a lot of heat, but very little light. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Well, why don't we start by looking at the basic facts, because it seems that's what's missing here. You point out that the term partial birth abortion is, first of all, not in any medical dictionary.
It doesn't exist. It is not a medical term. It's a contrived term.
So what is this that anti-choice groups are referring to and that pro-choice activists are trying to save?
Well, originally, when the law was first introduced in 1995, and the pro-choice groups learned that the following week these hearings would begin to be held in Washington, they really didn't know what the point was. It was called a partial birth abortion. They found out about women who were patients of a Dr. McMahon in California who did something called intact dilation and evacuation. This procedure was what they thought that the anti-choice people were talking about. Dr. McMahon did procedures with women who had fetal anomaly and who were really in difficult circumstances and needed to have abortions. Basically, it involves dilation of the cervix and evacuation of the contents of the uterus. The way Dr. McMahon did the procedure was to bring the fetus down into the uterus and to insert a needle into the fetal head to remove some of the contents so that the head compressed and could be removed, and so the fetus could be removed intact from the woman's body. Dr. McMahon did these procedures because he felt there was no alternative for these women that was as safe. Shortly after this, it came to the attention of the pro-choice people as well that there was another procedure called dilation and extraction, which is also dilation and evacuation. Basically, the difference is dilation and extraction involves bringing the fetus down in a breech position so that the feet come through first, the fetus begins to emerge from the uterus, which is why they called it a partial birth abortion. And then the physician who developed that technique, whose name is Dr. Haskell, inserts the needle and collapses the skull and again brings the fetus out. So it's basically two procedures.
And the head then is the last thing to come out.
Yes, in that case, the head would be the last thing to come out. And the idea is that the woman does not have to be cut. You don't have to do a preterm labor. It's the contention of the physicians has been that it's the easiest procedure on the woman's body at that point. Now, the problem is that there have not been any peer-reviewed scientific studies of these procedures compared to other procedures, so that when people talk about safety, we really don't have the scientific grounding we need to say that. We need more information.
Is it because, I mean, are these studies not done because doctors are afraid to write about it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And what happened here is Dr. Haskell and Dr. McMahon at the same National Abortion Federation conference presented papers describing these two procedures. One of the papers, Dr. Haskell's, made its way to the National Right to Life Committee, and that is how this all began. They were outraged by the description of this procedure, which, frankly, is understandable. The description is very disturbing. And that was just more ammunition against the doctors in terms of their fear of going out into the public and discussing their practice and how they perform their practice. So, yes, we don't have those studies a lot because of fear and because of money.
Can you talk about what the bill says that is now being debated in Congress?
The bill basically says that a procedure, I'm going to just read to you exactly what the bill says. The critical section of the bill referring to abortion procedures says, any physician who knowingly performs a partial birth abortion and thereby kills a human fetus shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 2 years or both. The term partial birth abortion means an abortion in which the person performing the abortion partially vaginally delivers a living fetus before killing the fetus and completing the delivery. And that is the key. Part of the fetus has to be alive as the fetus is coming, as the abortion is being done, in order for this, for the procedure to fall under the ban. And that's a very vague concept because there are a lot of different abortion procedures. In a lot of them, physicians do terminate the fetal life before the fetus comes out of the uterus at all. In other cases, they don't know the exact moment that the fetus dies. So physicians who are doing other techniques could also come under the ban. And that's part of the reason that there's a lot of fear about what this is going to do to abortion practice. It's the government really looking over the physician's shoulder and dictating abortion practice.
Who wrote the bill?
Originally, I think it was the Right to Life people with Representative Kennedy, who's the first person who introduced it back in 1995, and that's where its origins were. But this came out of the National Right to Life Committee. They began the discussions of what this was and a campaign to outlaw it.
There was a very interesting piece in yesterday's Christian Science Monitor about the significance of the legislation around what the anti-choice activists are calling partial birth abortion. It says that 11 states have enacted bans covering this controversial form of late-term abortion, 8 of them this year alone. In 2 more states, bills await the governor's signature, and at least 22 additional states, legislatures are still considering bills. And the point of this article is that the whole move toward the late-term abortions represents a profound shift in the abortion debate. For the first time, attention's focused on what happens to the fetus during an abortion rather than to women. And that legislatures provide 50 different venues, because there are 50 legislatures, for opponents of abortion to publicize how the abortion is performed, and they hope to swing public opinion away from all abortions. Ultimately, it's believed that one of these cases will go to the Supreme Court and once again challenge Roe versus Wade.
Definitely, definitely. And I'm glad you brought that up, Amy. I think the movement around the country is so strong that this has really disturbed people a lot. And my mission in doing this article and Ms.'s mission in both my article and the roundtable that appears in this issue is to open the debate up on the pro-choice side. I think a lot of us have been really afraid to sit down and talk about what this issue means and what issues it raises for us. There has been a fear, I think, that we won't kind of come out at the right place. But Gloria Felt, who's the head of Planned Parenthood, said it beautifully when she said, pro-choice people are on all sides of this issue, but what we agree on is that Jesse Helms ought not to be making these decisions. And I think we can't lose sight of that bottom line. It's raising a lot of issues for us about abortion procedures and how they're done and when they're done and who has them. And we need, as pro-choice people, to wrestle with those issues. But these are not decisions that belong in the hands of congresspeople and senators. They belong in the hands of our doctors and our families.
In your piece in Ms. Magazine this month, Angela Bonavaglia, you talk about the case of Vicki Wilson, who is someone we've had on Democracy Now! But for listeners who didn't hear her story, can you explain what happened to her medically and then what happened to her politically in Congress?
Mm-hmm. Vicki Wilson was the mother of a couple of children, very happily married, pregnant, delighted, couldn't wait to have her next child. And she was 36 weeks pregnant when she discovered that the brain of her fetus had grown outside the fetus's head, so that the size of the fetal head was 2 or 3 times the normal size. There was no way that this fetus was going to be viable, be able to survive. He was not compatible with life. She needed an abortion. The other concern was that the delivery of that fetus would be very medically hazardous to her and would compromise her ability to have children in the future. She asked, "What can I have a C-section?" And a C-section involves major surgery. The time to recover from a C-section is very lengthy. And her doctor said, I can't put you through that. Those risks we take when there is a viable fetus and a chance for life, and there really isn't here. So there are a handful of physicians in the country, three or four that I know of, who do abortions after viability, when, by the way, the figures, the most dependable figures we have, show only 300 to 600 procedures are done. Vicky found one of these doctors, and that doctor was Dr. McMahon in California. And she traveled to him with her family, and she had an intact dilation and evacuation in Dr.
DNA
in Dr. McMahon's office. It was not traumatic in terms of her physical body the way a preterm C-section would have been. She was able to take the fetus after the delivery. You know, I think we have this grotesque image of what the fetus looks like when it's delivered in this fashion. This fetus was, its face was a child's face, but its head, of course, was deeply deformed. It was swaddled. She was able to hold it. So did her husband. So did her children, and say goodbye. For her, this was the way to end what was a truly catastrophic, devastating pregnancy. She got a call from Dr. McMahon shortly thereafter that this procedure was, that the Congress was attempting to outlaw this procedure, and she was devastated. And she joined pro-choice groups and other women who had had abortions in those circumstances to appear before the House Judiciary Committee, which was a nightmare. She was told she was part of a radical fringe. That was by Bob Inglis.
Republican from South Carolina.
Thank you. She was told, he referred to the abortion provider as a hired assassin. Another woman who had a similar procedure reported being referred to as an exterminator, and Pat Schroeder, who was there, Congresswoman Pat Schroeder from Colorado, said it really was like a witchcraft trial, that it was a horrendous experience.
But now today, news out of Chicago that late-term abortions that some say is needed to ensure the health of the mother is usually not needed for that purpose at all, according to the American Medical Association. The AMA board reported yesterday that except in extraordinary circumstances, maternal health factors which demand termination of the pregnancy can be accommodated without sacrifice of the fetus. It goes on to say, although third trimester abortions can be performed to preserve the life or health of the mother, they are in fact generally not necessary for those purposes. It's the first ever AMA paper on the procedure in which, and then it describes what the procedure is, and it says it'll become official policy of the 300,000 member medical group if approved by its House of Delegates at its annual meeting next month. What do you make of this?
Well, the AMA has certainly not been particularly brave about this issue. While ACOG, the American College of Gynecologists and Obstetricians, was very direct about it. They admitted that we do not have the scientific data, but they said that in some circumstances, in the doctor's estimation, this can be the best procedure for the woman, and that is where the decision belongs. And I think they were really on the right track. The AMA spokesperson that I talked to, whose name is Dr. Nelson, basically said he wasn't worried about the passage of this legislation, because if he as a physician had to use any of these techniques in the middle of a surgery, he felt that he would be protected. He would be able to say that it protected the health and life of the mother. But in fact, that is not what the law would say. The law as it stands now, the House law, the House bill that has been passed, says that it can only be used to protect the life of the mother. So a physician who argues that it's only being used to protect the health of the mother would be subject to criminal prosecution. And that means the AMA physician who said that.
You know, it's interesting that the AMA says that the decision should be left to doctors, but that they see no identified situation that requires it. That's very strong.
Mm-hmm. It is very strong. It is very strong.
I mean, word has it among pro-choice activists that are working hard on this issue that while President Clinton stood strong on this, as you point out, almost alone, well, with pro-choice groups, but certainly in the more mainstream political climate in Washington, that he is going to compromise on this.
He's probably going to go one. There are two options now, and there may be one of these that he feels he has to go with. We don't know. We don't know at this point.
The two options are?
The partial birth abortion ban, as we've been discussing, and Senator Daschle's bill, which is an alternate bill being proposed that would outlaw all post-viability abortions except in the cases of a threat to the woman's health. Now, there's a lot of discussion about whether it will be physical health, grievous damage to her health, not mental health. So that is, And that was an attempt almost to codify Roe, which says we have a law right now that says that after viability, an abortion can only be done if it's a threat to the woman's life or health. So this alternate legislation was originally attempted as an alternative to the partial birth abortion ban, but it raises its own issues by narrowing, telling a doctor that he has to find a way to define grievous health consequences. What's a grievous health consequence? You know, a doctor's going to be taking all kinds of risks if he or she starts to try to define that in a way the Congress is going to accept.
Is grievous a woman not being able to have another child?
Is grievous a heart problem, a lung problem, a diabetes attack? You know, what's grievous injury?
Well, on that note, we have to wrap up this discussion. Angela Bonavolia, thank you very much for joining us. She's got the cover story of the latest Ms. magazine. It's called Let's Really Talk About Late-Term Abortion. And again, as we wrap up this discussion, just to read what the bill actually does say, the critical section of it referring to abortion procedures. It says, any physician who knowingly performs a partial birth abortion and thereby kills a human fetus shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 2 years or both. The term partial birth abortion means an abortion in which the person performing the abortion partially vaginally delivers a living fetus before killing the fetus and completing the delivery. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 1 minute. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The piece starts like this. Someone fired a shot through the glass window of a coffee shop by the United Nations just above the head of Catherine Claxton. Another bullet shattered Claxton's windshield as she drove home from her job at the UN one night on the Long Island Expressway. Claxton's red 1988 Hyundai was almost run off the road in the same spot on the expressway on three other occasions. The incidents, revealed for the first time in the Village Voice this week, occurred after Claxton became the first woman to launch a sexual harassment case against the United Nations. The case itself made headlines and history. But what Claxton suffered after she filed her grievance, the gunshots and office ransacking in which her diaries were stolen, her computer sabotaged, heavy breathing, crank calls, and one bizarre lion-like roar into the phone marking the end of a 6-year ordeal, has never been disclosed until now. Well, like many other institutions, sexual harassment at the United Nations headquarters in New York City is widespread. But the world body is doing very little, if not nothing, about it. The UN, for example, didn't even have a sexual harassment policy until 1992. We're going to talk about this issue with two people. Jennifer Gould, who is the journalist who did the cover story of the Village Voice this week called Sexual Harassment at the United Nations. And we're also joined by Cecile Gross, who is a lawyer retired from the United Nations. She was formerly president of the Women's Group, a voluntary staff association at the World Body. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, why don't we talk first a little more about Catherine Claxton's case as you describe it, Jennifer. Who was Catherine Claxton?
Catherine Claxton was a woman who has been working at the UN since the 1970s. She's been there for a long time, very well respected there. And she was one of the only women to speak up against sexual harassment. One of the reasons she was able to was because she's an American. What I mean by that is that most women there who do suffer discrimination and harassment are not American. They're dependent on visas to stay in the country. So if things happen with their bosses, they stay quiet because if they don't, they don't only risk losing a job, they also risk having to be deported.
Who was she being harassed by?
She was being harassed by a man who was a very senior man, an Undersecretary General of the United Nations by the time he left the organization. He was a senior Argentinian diplomat, and he was also a very good friend of the former Secretary General.
What was his name?
His name was Mario Luis Gomez.
And what exactly happened? I just laid out the outline there.
Well, this man had apparently been harassing more than one individual, not just Catherine Claxton. In her case, she was in his office at one time when he basically threw her against a wall and grabbed her and, as the article says, forced his tongue down her mouth and got very insulted when she told him that this wasn't what she wanted. He said, "How dare you think you're not good enough for me?"
Or, "You're too good for me."
And it was, you know, an incredibly outrageous situation. But what really took courage was for Catherine Claxton to actually talk about this. When she broke down in tears once with one girlfriend, she was told, you know, it's a terrible thing to have to go through, but a lot of women here have been through situations like this, and unfortunately, there's nothing you can really do. You better just keep quiet. So she was the first one to really break the silence, and even though there was no grievance procedure, nothing in place to really, you know, to take this to a higher body at the UN, she did it anyways, and she should really be commended for that courage.
But she did it years later.
She did it a few years later, yes, and she only did it when her job was at stake. She finally felt that this man was going to terminate her job because he, you know, there was so much antagonism from this one incident. And there, possibly also because there was no procedure in place for sexual harassment, she waited and filed a grievance about her job, and only incidentally did the sexual harassment issue come up.
And then what happened when it became known and broke in some New York papers?
Right after the story broke in a New York newspaper, she was sitting in a coffee shop across the street from the United Nations when a gunshot shattered the window. It's just an amazing thing. She was followed on her way home from work, intimidated with phone calls, sometimes days, weeks on end for over 2 years.
You said sometimes 15 minutes apart for whole nights.
Yes. And, you know, I mean, it was a terrifying thing. Her office was ransacked. Files disappeared off her computer.
She was shot at in a car.
She was shot at in a car, followed, and, you know, a very creepy way also. It would always, someone tried to run her off the road three times in the same spot on the Long Island Expressway.
And so what ultimately happened to this man?
Ultimately, he resigned shortly after a report came out, you know, charging him with the sexual harassment. But the UN then tried to hire him back, and that was announced at his retirement party. And he was going to be rehired for a dollar a year, but there was a per diem for $200 a day. And there was such outrage that this ended up being dropped. But then again, a while later, the UN tried to rehire him again. And after outrage, they had to retract that as well.
That is just one story. Cecile Gross, you're a retired lawyer from the United Nations. And I guess because you're retired, it's the one reason why you're one of the few people who work there, women, who can actually talk about these cases.
Exactly. Because when you're a staff member, you're not permitted to discuss anything unless given permission by the Secretary General, and certainly not to bring into public scrutiny the kind of problems that the UN is facing with women.
In fact, Catherine Claxton wasn't allowed to talk about her case. Is that
oh,
right?
No. But aside from the usual gag order, when the results of the final investigation on her case came out, the Secretary General specifically instructed her that no part of the report should be revealed or she would be disciplined. And it was only because it was eventually leaked to the press that the public found out what happened.
Is this problem pervasive at the United Nations?
Yeah, it is pervasive. And it's to be expected that it would be, because there are no controls. There is no constituency of the UN as we know it. While the voters here in this country, for example, would not permit government officials who consistently abused employees' rights to be reelected.
I wonder.
Hopefully. Instead, the UN has really no constituency except the member states. Now, the member states come to the UN with their list of priorities, and I don't know any government that has on its priority list the treatment of UN staff, much less the treatment of women, much less the avoidance of abuse of women.
Was this raised at the UN conference on women in Beijing? I mean, it would have been a perfect place and would certainly have brought a lot of attention around what was going on. And once you look at the United Nations, it would also put pressure, you know, workplaces around the world.
Everyone who was at the conference knows about this. It wasn't a new item. There have been women conferences for the last 20 years, I think. And all those who go there know what the situation is. By and large, it's considered not politically savvy to make this an issue when there are so-called bigger issues that have worldwide implications. This, of course, is naive because the UN itself is a microcosm of the world, plus its work that has to carry out throughout the world is compromised if it doesn't treat its own staff properly. Not only because it should be a model for the rest of the world, but if its own staff does not have the proper representation of women at high levels, at policy-making levels, its own work will not reflect the concerns of women throughout the world.
Jennifer Gould, you paint a pretty harsh picture of what goes on, for example, if you look in the General Assembly following up on what Cecile Gross is saying, of the men all sitting there and the women scurrying about getting their coffee and papers.
Definitely. That is, you know, when I started this story, I had no idea about anything that I would find. And I started off with an idea of just wanting to profile one woman who was in a senior position. And the more I looked into the story, the more I realized how few women there were and the more stories about sexual harassment I heard. And that's when I realized that's what the story at the UN really is. One of the things is that women I know who work there, women who are diplomats, who go to the General Assembly, are the ones who started talking to me about this story in the first place, how, you know, what it's like to be a young woman diplomat at a place like the UN and to be in a room filled with men. And the women are all fairly young and attractive in short skirts and heels walking around handing out speeches to the older diplomats.
Cecile Gross, you're wincing.
Right. Well, to say that the women who work in the conference rooms are selected for their skirts or their heels might be overstating it. But you don't find many elderly women there. You don't find many men there. It is a selection of the fittest. Yeah.
What about how this extends out when the United Nations goes, for example, on a peacekeeping mission? You describe that well, Jennifer Gould, in your piece on sexual harassment at the United Nations, when even lower-level people get in positions of power and what that means for the staff of the UN who go out to countries to work on a mission, and also, you can only assume by extension, to the local population.
Well, that's the second part of the story that's going to be in The Voice next week, expanded on. But the stories there are absolutely outrageous. If you look at Cambodia or Somalia or, you know, the former Yugoslavia, places where there are UN peacekeeping missions, there are really terrible stories of abuse, stories of both UN peacekeeper soldiers who are abusing, even raping local women and children. There are also stories about UN hired officials, the civilians in charge, who are doing the same things or who knew about situations and didn't do anything about it. There are really horrible stories and, you know, possibly two reasons why people who are going into these war zones or conflict zones aren't being given any training for sensitivity or what it's like to deal with this local staff. And you also have situations where male UN civilian officials are actually abusing their colleagues who are also from the UN who are female. You have lower level officials in positions of power that they never had before, finding themselves in extremely harried situations and really abusing their power.
Well, Cecile Gross, what does the UN sexual harassment policy say that was instituted in 1992?
Oh, it's a perfectly good definition of sexual harassment. I don't have it at my fingertips, but it's something everyone could live with, and more or less that any overtures or promises or threats of a sexual nature concerning a staff member's employment is strictly forbidden, et cetera, et cetera. Plus, it sets out a process whereby complaints can be made and what will be done with them. However, it has no safeguards for the complainer. And in the power structure, complainers generally, anyone who complains about the establishment, does so at his or her risk. Now, for a woman, and usually a young woman is the subject of the harassment, to come forward and complain about a superior risks possibly everything. The UN keeps a lot of young women on short-term employment, and it's their boss, their immediate supervisor, who decides whether they have a job next month.
Well, explain what that means when you say risks almost anything, because anyone, you know, who speaks up at a job risks a tremendous amount. But at the United Nations, let's say you're talking about the UN headquarters in New York, you're talking about possibly being deported.
No question. Young women, for example, who may be here with families and extended families, may be on short-term employment. If the pass is made, they must consider at that point whether to accept a pass or to resist it. Resistance may mean that when their employment is up next week or next month or 2 months hence, it will not be renewed on the recommendation of their boss, who need not give any great explanation of why he does not wish to renew her. And within 30 days of the end of her employment, she loses her G4 visa, and she, her family, and her extended family can no longer stay in the U.S. That's what she's got to think about.
And these visas, these short-term contracts, can be for as little as 3 months. So these women have to face this every 3 months or every 6 months.
Yep, be there for years.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What is Kofi Annan doing about this right now, the new UN Secretary General? What does he have to decide on?
Well, Kofi Annan himself is a decent gentleman. He works well with women. He's not the type that one should complain about. However, he's new in the job. Whether he has given attention to this aspect with the many woes and troubles that the UN faces, whether he's given attention to this yet, I haven't got a clue. But I would guess that it's not a high priority item while he's trying to hold the organization together and possibly the world together.
Yeah, people tend to really like him. Women say, oh, he's wonderful. He does work well with women. At the same time, out of his first 18 appointments, only two of them were women. And there's also the sexual harassment policy that officials at the UN are talking about, that this is going to be great. This is going to help them really define a term of sexual harassment, which is another problem when you're talking about people from 185 different countries who have such extraordinarily different views on women in their own countries. But this sexual harassment questionnaire has not even gone out to any UN staffers, and it's taken the UN more than 2 years, or almost 2 years, to come up with formulating the questions. And apparently the sexual harassment questionnaire is now waiting for the new Secretary General's approval, that it, you know, it's been ready and it's waiting. And of course he has a lot of things to do, but you know, it doesn't seem like this is a top priority.
But it's typical. The need of a questionnaire is not there.
Right.
Sexual harassment has been defined in the UN. There are no problems with the definition. The idea that people from various cultures can't agree on this is nonsense.
It reminds me of the whole debate over Asian human rights values. They say that it's different. Well, for the vast populations of people in different Asian countries, they would say they have no different idea of human rights than anyone anywhere else. Mm-hmm. It's the governments who want to say that there's a different standard. It's those in power who want to say that there's a different standard. We want to thank you very much for joining us. I'm sorry we have to cut this conversation short, but just to let people know, the two women who've been appointed to those top UN positions, only two, are Gillian Martin-Sorensen, Assistant Secretary General for External Relations, and Angela King, Assistant Secretary General and Special Advisor on Gender Issues and the Advancement of Women. Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Again, Jennifer Gould did the piece in the Village Voice this week called Sexual Harassment at the United Nations, and that piece will be followed up by another next week. Sorry about that. And Cecile Gross, a retired UN lawyer. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back. Listening to Democracy Now! Yes, that's Tracy Chapman singing Rape of the World, and I thought it would be nicer to listen to her than to listen to me coughing for a few minutes, and it does apply to what we've been talking about. But now we're moving on to another issue. You are listening to Democracy Now!, and I'm Amy Goodman. Some 2,700 workers at ABC TV have been working without a contract for nearly 2 months. ABC's parent company, Walt Disney, is insisting on takebacks from technicians and other workers at the television network, including the elimination of company pension contributions. Meanwhile, Disney continues to mistreat its employees in the garment factories and sweatshops of the world. A 12-year-old girl, for instance, was recently found working in a Los Angeles factory that manufactures Disney products. Now an unusual coalition of Disney workers is developing. The ABC TV technicians are making common cause with the sweatshop workers and free trade zones of developing countries. Joining us to talk about the Bust Mickey, Not Union campaign is two people. We're joined by Bob Masters, who's the New England Political and Legislative Director of the Communications Workers of America, known as CWA, and Charlie Kernighan, who is with the National Labor Committee in support of worker and human rights in Central America. The National Labor Committee has spearheaded campaigns against retail giants like The Gap and Walmart for paying starvation wages to female workers in free trade zones of Central America and the Caribbean. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thanks.
And I hope I can get through this segment. Well, Charlie Kernighan, why don't we start with you? By the way, you were very good the other night at the Counter Clio Awards, giving one of those awards against advertisers in this country. And I think it clearly tied right in to the kind of work that you're doing right now. Talk about this expanding coalition.
Well, it's been enormously interesting and productive. We've always said what goes around comes around. What these companies do offshore, they're going to do in the United States. They may do it in a different form, but they're going to do it. And Disney's the perfect example. I mean, we've known for a long time about the Disney production through contractors in Haiti paying this miserable starvation 28 cent an hour wage where the workers are also stripped of their rights. I mean, if they try to organize, they're fired. We know of Disney toy production in Indonesia using 13-year-old girls, essentially, just graduates of the fifth grade, working, making Disney toys pay 21 cents an hour and working full shifts illegally, working all night, all day. Same thing in Thailand. Same thing in China. Toys being made by Disney by young women, maybe 17, 18, 19 years old, forced to work 12-hour shifts 7 days a week, 13 cents an hour. And, of course, one of the latest cases is this connection between Disney and McDonald's that have hooked up in this enormous advertising promotional venture, where when you go into a McDonald's now and get a Happy Meal, the promotional toy you're going to receive is one of the Disney characters. For example, they ran 20 miniature Dalmatians, and they were given away all during last December. And McDonald's says that they're going to bring the magic of Disney into McDonald's so that families can enjoy this magic, and children can learn. And children can learn to think and develop their imaginations. What they did not tell you was that the toys were made in Vietnam at a factory where they employed 17-year-old women, forced them to work 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, and paid them 6 cents an hour. So you're talking a 70-hour work week for $4.20. And on top of it, they suffered from high exposure to acetone, a chemical solvent, which can cause lung damage and kidney damage.
So, Bob Masters, what does the Communication Workers of America have to do with this?
Well, there's two aspects to it. I mean, one is that our union has worked actually with Charlie for many years, in Charlie's earlier incarnation, doing solidarity work for Central American trade unionists and progressive Nicaraguan trade unionists. We lent resources organizational support to his efforts to protect those trade unionists. So, you know, our union has always had a concern about international trade union issues. In this particular instance, we represent 2,700 workers at ABC, which is now a wholly owned subsidiary of the Disney Corporation. And I think that when you get into a fight, the kind of fight that we're in now, really a fight to preserve the strength of our union and the decency of the working conditions that we have, you begin to see a larger picture because, you know, when you get in a fight against a company like Disney, you begin to look more closely at its practices worldwide.
What do the 2,700 workers who you represent do?
They're the off-air people who make the television stations, both the network and the owned and affiliated stations in the major cities run. They edit film. They run cameras. They our technical directors, so on and so forth.
Have you had any direct dialogue with Disney?
Disney has tried very, very hard to maintain the fiction that ABC is an autonomous entity inside of the Disney empire and has so far tried to stay away from labor negotiations, although when we did some actions at the shareholders meeting along with many of the people who are concerned about the issues that Charlie has been raising. Eisner made very clear from the podium that he was well aware of what was going on with ABC negotiations.
What did you do at the shareholder meeting?
We supported the progressive resolutions that were raised about sweatshop practices and also about executive compensation. I think probably most of your listeners know that we're dealing with Michael Eisner is one of the poster boys for American corporate greed. His most recent 10-year contract is estimated to be worth as much as $928 million, which is a pretty nice chunk of change if you can get it. You know, we had people leafleting and demonstrating outside the shareholders' meeting.
And Charlie Kernaghan, what were you all doing out there? What groups were represented outside of CWA?
Well, it was the same broad coalition of people working to push Disney in the right direction, to end this use of sweatshop abuses offshore. And as a matter of fact, it was 9% of the shareholders voted with us on the issue of ending sweatshop abuses, and more voted on the issue of this obscene corporate compensation for people like Eisner. You know, if they tell us that the average medium family income in the United States is $40,000 a year. If you look at what Michael Eisner made last year, and he paid himself $8.7 million in salary and then took $181 million a corporate grant, the New York Times referred to it as the largest corporate grant in the history of the world. Well, that means that Michael Eisner is worth more than 5,000 U.S. Families. And Michael Eisner's salary last year was exceeded the salary of 290,000 Haitian workers. I mean, these people are just moving so far away from us, so far away from everyday people, that they think they control the whole system. And the greed that's driving Disney and the corruption that's driving Disney, it's out of control.
We're talking to Charlie Kernaghan, who heads up the National Labor Committee, and Bob Masters, the New England Political and Legislative Director of the Communications Workers of America. By the way, these groups and others are going to be holding a protest today in the afternoon, 6 o'clock or 5:30 Eastern Standard Time in New York City at a Disney store, which seems to be an ongoing series of protests. Bob Masters, since you are representing those people, 2,700 people, who are making the on-air people look good and making it all possible to get their voices and faces out across America, have you had any dialogue with these people who hold much more sway with the powers that be, or in fact, many of those powers that be? What is the response of, for example, people like Ted Koppel and Diane Sawyer and Sam Donaldson?
I honestly don't know. I mean, I think that, you know, these people are making very nice livings working for these big media corporations, and they're not too likely to try to bite the hand that feeds them. So while there may be some sympathy, you know, on the part of some of these folks who are actually union members in AFTRA, you know, we haven't had a lot of, you know, active support.
Wouldn't that be something if we heard in one of their contract negotiations where they're, you know, fighting to have $7 or $9 million a year, whatever, that they were also saying that they would not stay at the network, and many of them, you know, the company will do anything to keep there, would not stay at the network unless workers in Haiti are paid more than 20 cents, 28 cents an hour, or perhaps Communication Workers of America workers were given fair contracts.
That would be great.
Hollywood is often very silent when it comes to worker rights issues. They're more pronounced when it comes to political issues. It's a lot safer. We found that out with our Haiti work. The minute we started talking about Disney and 28 cents an hour wages, Hollywood disappeared.
Charlie Kernaghan, you were at the Anti-Clio Awards, the Counter-Clio Awards, the highest awards given to advertisers in this country, the ones that shape so much of what so many believe in this country. Why were you there?
Well, in my particular case, it was to award Nike the Lifetime Achievement Award for hypocrisy and greed. The only company that came close would be a Disney. Would be Disney ABC. But here was, you know, Nike with its ads about empowering women and children and just do it and give this woman a chance and give her a ball and somebody's going to give her a doll, but give her a chance. And, of course, the way they treat their workers in Indonesia or Vietnam or China. So it seemed to me very appropriate that they'd get the award and that we'd say something truthful about how they treat the workers in Vietnam, for example, making them run laps if they're not in the hot sun, 90-degree temperature, if they were not wearing their proper factory attire. In that same factory, several months before, the women were actually not lined up, 15 women, and they were beaten over the heads with the uppers of the Nike sneakers because they were seen to be wasting too many pieces. And one woman was knocked unconscious, and the rest were left badly bruised and somewhat bloody. Other incidences is that they've actually taped the mouths of the women shut with duct tape if they're talking too much or saying things that management doesn't want to hear. So it was important to get this sort of information out. And, of course, their wages are 20 cents an hour, which was maybe less than half what it would cost just to eat three meals and get back and forth to work, let alone support a family. So the truth behind the Nike advertising, and again, much like Disney, Nike spends $650 million a year on advertising. That's $1.8 million a day. Every day they're putting out $1.8 million worth of advertising. And they're slapping that swoosh sign on all of us. And, you know, they're paying big bucks for it. So just to get some of the truth out about the situation.
We talked to you just after the summit you held in New York City with groups around Central and South America and groups from Asia as well, talking about how these alliances were going to form to fight sweatshop labor wherever it might be in this country or somewhere else. We didn't talk after the presidential task force on sweatshops gave out their report and said now that these companies like Liz Claiborne and Nike and Reebok are going to set up a set of rules that they'll abide by. What is your feeling now about where that is going? And what are the groups that you're working with doing to monitor these worldwide standards they say they're setting up?
Well, you have to realize that the accord that was that the president announced really is just a blueprint. Nothing exists now. I mean, no one belongs to anything. Nothing exists. And what their strategy is to make the announcement and then just go back to business as usual. After being somewhat stunned by the weakness of the accord, we took a very different approach. If they publicly announce an accord to end sweatshops and they make up this worldwide code of no child labor and no forced overtime and the right to organize unions and this sort of thing, no sexual harassment. Like, if they put this out into the public under the president's name and tell us that they're going to, over the next 6 months, they're going to work to implement this accord. They're going to fill in the details. They're going to design a whole structure to implement this accord, how to end sweatshops and how it should be monitored. I think it does provide now an enormous opportunity for the U.S. public to jump in. We can write to the president. We can petition. We can tell them what we want and what we know is necessary to end sweatshop abuses. And so what we're doing is we're planning demonstrations and actions all across the country in October, right at the time when the accord is to be finalized and released by the president.
Will this ultimately lead to a no-sweat label?
It could. I mean, it's nowhere near there now, but it could, because this is what people want. People are sick of buying products that are made by children or exploited women. They want to know that they're buying a product that was made under humane conditions. So that, in some ways, is the ultimate goal. The companies are terrified to death of that. I mean, they don't want any part of it. They don't want any part of a no-sweat label. So this is absolutely the goal, but we're very far away from it. But the mistake that the administration made and the mistake that the companies made was to have made this public and thrown it out into the public domain, very mainstream domain, you know, again, including the president and including the industry, and it gives us a foothold to work.
So you see that you have an opening, that overall this is positive.
Yeah, we're not going to wait for 2 seconds. We're going right through the door.
What is the number of the National Labor Committee if people want to find out more about the activities in October or anything else that you're planning leading right up to the rally today that's in New York at the Disney store?
They can reach us at 212 area code, and the number is 242-3002. I think the demonstration tonight is very critical, because when we start to bring forces together, religious people, solidarity people, consumer groups, with the main unions, this is enormously important and deliver a huge message to Disney.
And Bob Masters, the phone number of Communication Workers of America.
212-344-2515.
That's 212-344-2515. 2515. I want to thank you both very much, Bob Masters of CWA, Charlie Kernighan of the National Labor Committee in New York City, for joining us. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Our engineer and assistant producer is Errol Maitland. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. Thanks to Zachary Fink. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!